Chapter 15. I was nearly convinced I had the wrong alley. I waited 10 minutes, then 15, then I walked off. I got to the end of the block, and I turned around and walked back. I looked down the alleyway. It wasn't much of an alleyway, just a narrow space between two buildings, wide enough for the fire exits and trash cans. The 15 minutes I'd spent standing in the alley had been enough time for me to memorize every single feature of the place, from the ancient, mossy urine streaks on the wall to the dents in the trash cans. And now I could see that something was different. Hadn't that trash can been over there? It had been. I took a cautious step into the alleyway, and my palms slicked with sweat, because I could tell, somehow, that there was someone in there with me. I took another step. "Back here," a voice said from behind the trash cans. I tried to peek over them, but I couldn't quite see, so I went deeper in and came around them. Masha was sitting with her back against the wall. She looked like she was on her way to the gym, in track pants and a loose t-shirt, her hair in a pink scrunchie, a gym bag beside her. Her hair was mousy, no-color brown, and she was wearing big fake designer shades. She could have been rich or poor, teenaged or in her late 20s. I wouldn't have given her a second look if I'd sat next to her on BART. I wasn't sure it was her, until she lowered her shades on her nose and skewered me on her glare. "Have a seat," she said, and gestured at the space next to her behind the trash cans. She'd put down a piece of new cardboard there, which was a nice touch and made me think this wasn't the first time she'd done this. I lowered myself into a cross-legged position. "Nice to see you," I said. "A bit unexpected." "Yeah," she said. "Zeb and I walked out of there a few days ago, but it's been busy." "Walked out of there? Those Ziz people? They're mostly meatheads that couldn't cut it in the DHS, so they went private sector, tripled their pay, and set out on their own. They have a lot of faith in their systems. Like, say, if a vendor says a CCTV is secure, they believe it. Same with electronic door locks, tracking ankle cuffs, and perimeter sensors." "Oh," I said. I'd always known that Masha was a million times more badass than I was, but in all this business about saving her, I'd somehow come to think of her as a damsel in distress. "Did you have to come far? Are you asking where I was held?" I shrugged. "Are you sure you want to know that?" I shrugged again. "Probably not. All this spy shit, I pretty much totally hate it, to tell you the truth. Is Zeb okay?"
"Zeb's as good as he has any right to expect. Better. He's doing some stuff on his own for a while."
I mentally translated this as, "We had a big fight and split up."
"Oh. So, I wanted to say thanks," she said. "You've done some stuff that needed doing, but you did it for me and Zeb, and that was damned good of you, even if spy shit isn't your thing."
"Yeah," I said. "Well, glad to be of service, even if you didn't need me in the end."
"Oh, I needed you. Ziz has been in an absolute panic pretty much since the moment they grabbed us. I figured out pretty quick that you were behind it. They were awfully anxious to know what had gotten out, what else might come out, and how they could stop it. They had a lot of really sincere questions for me, but it was an excellent distraction. And from what I can tell, all the people who supplied me with that material are happy with how it's gotten out. There was a lot more material waiting for me when I got back online, enough to keep me busy for a really long time." She was being super macho, but I was starting to see that there was something wrong with her. She rooted in her gym bag for a water bottle and took a slug of it. I saw big, ugly bruises, no, welts, on her wrists and at her throat. I swallowed. "Well, glad to be of service. Wish I'd known, since I happened upon some more material of my own recently." I told her about Carrie Johnstone's docs and the source of them. "I see," she said in sober tones. "And where are these files now?"
"I emailed them to Ziz Corporate Headquarters," I said. I have to admit I was a little proud of the silence that followed. She might have been James Bond meets Spider-Man, but I'd managed to do something so heroically crazy, stupid, brave that I'd rendered her speechless. But the silence went on and on and on.
I peered at her shades, trying to see if she'd fallen asleep behind them. Shush, she said. I'm figuring angles. Oh. She lowered her head for a moment, and I heard her muttering to herself. There was a raw ligature mark around the back of her neck, which disappeared beneath her chin. So if I have this straight, you've sent all this into Ziz and to Johnstone personally. You've implied that you're ready to publish it at the drop of a hat, but as far as they know, you haven't actually done anything about getting it published, right? Pretty much. I've locked down the server my blog is on 6 Ways to Midnight, because I figured they'd be after it with everything they had. I'm half convinced they're going to come after me personally again, but that was always a certainty. They've tried to snatch me twice now. There's nothing I could do that would stop them from coming a third time. She nodded along with me and held up her hand as I came to the end. What if I could stop them? What do you mean? What if I could negotiate something with them? So that they made a meaningful promise to leave you alone, and you agreed to leave the Johnstone docks alone. Just so I'm clear on this. You've just escaped from a secret prison run by these goons, and now you're proposing to negotiate with them for my safety? As we say on the internets, WTF. Oh, she said. Marcus, come on. I'm not doing this to negotiate for your safety. I'm negotiating for mine. Derp. Right, I said. Right. And Zeb's. Zeb, you, me, your little girly, all of them. Ziz is stupid and evil, but it's a business. Money talks and bullshit walks. What you're about to dump, it will cost them plenty. If we give them a chance to cut their losses, they're going to do that. What about Johnstone? Won't she come after me after she's fired? They won't fire her, she said. Whatever reasons they have to fire her, you can be sure she has amassed a fat dossier of reasons why they shouldn't fire her. That woman's got the survival instincts of a cockroach. She only goes when she's ready to go. The U.S. Army only fired her once she was ready to be fired, once she'd set up the Ziz deal to step into. She let them fire her. You sound almost like you admire her, I said. The only day I wouldn't piss on Carrie Johnston is the day she caught fire, Masha said, without the slightest hesitation or expression. But if you're not prepared to learn from the teachers that life gives you, you'll always be ignorant. I've paid for every lesson that Carrie Johnstone has taught me, and I'm going to get my money's worth. Sitting with Masha was like sitting on a razor's edge. On one side was my old life. Safe little Marcus with his safe little life, in the system, applying for jobs, building his little electronics projects. On the other side was the life that I'd have if I followed Masha. Violence, secrecy, poverty, but also power, strength, and adventure. I could disappear from the world, become a ghost and a legend. A fugitive who only gave the system what I deemed it deserved, not what it demanded. After all, wasn't the system the problem? No matter who we voted for, the government always seemed to win. What was the point of living out my little fantasy of democratic change and justice when the real action was being fought out in secrecy, with anonymous envelopes of cash, encrypted whispers, secret bunkers, and secret deals? Masha got to her feet, and I was alarmed to see how slowly and painfully she moved. I was even more alarmed by how heavily she leaned against the wall. Give me a little help here, she said. I hastened to stand beside her and let her put her arm around my shoulders, putting a lot of weight on me. Her hair tickled my cheek. It still smelled of her hair dye, a smell I remembered from being a kid who tried a different hair color every week, back when I felt I could express who I was and what I felt with my hair. Come on, she said. Let's go use your network connection to do some negotiating before they scramble the black helicopters and nuke your ass. I haven't agreed to the deal, I said. I was practically holding her upright at this point, and I was amazed by how light she was, how little there was to her under her exercise clothes. Yeah, she said. And what else are you going to do, dipshit? Yeah, I said. All right, let's go get my bike. Screw that. If it's locked up, you can get it later. If it's not, someone else will get it, and you won't have to worry about it. Get us a cab. I've got money. Mom and Dad had left me a note saying they'd gone to a meeting with their accountant and telling me they'd be home for dinner. I raided the fridge for Masha while she used the shower and settled in my room. I sat down on the end of my bed and watched her gnaw at a hunk of cheese and a tray of cookies while her fingers flew over the keyboard. She stopped typing after a while and spun around on my chair, her wet hair whipping around her shoulder, leaving watermarks on her t-shirt. Okay, she said. Now we wait. I gave them an hour, so let's assume they'll get back to us within 2 hours. I don't like the idea of Carrie Johnstone just getting away with this, I said. She looked at me like I was a simpleton. I hated that look. People like Carrie Johnstone always get away with stuff until someone shoots them or they retire to some distant dictatorship where no one can get at them. She's not going to court. She'll never go to court. No one will ever arrest her. No one can afford to arrest her. You need to get past this romantic idea of justice and realize that some stuff just is. I hate that, I said. It's like there's no human beings in the chain of responsibility, just things that happen. It's the ultimate cop-out. The system did it. The company did it. The government did it. What about the person who pulls the trigger? Yeah, she said. Well, that's a nice fairy tale. Have you got any juice or soda? Something with sugar? I'm crashing here. Maybe some coffee. I made her an epic cup of coffee. I may not be a ninja secret agent, but that's one thing I could most certainly do. She drank it with something approaching the proper reverence, sent me for another drink, drank that, and said, okay, this'll do. But the way she said it, I could tell that it was Masha Ease for, holy crap, that is awesome coffee! Then she typed some more. Then she typed some more. Then she made a face like she smelled something bad and her fingers bounced over the keys like a troop of 10 meth-addled acrobats on 89 little trampolines. Then some more typing, her teeth bared like an animal. I tried to peek over her shoulder. I used a polarized laptop shield that made it impossible to see the screen unless you were looking at it straight on, and she batted me aside without even seeing me. More typing. Yeah, that'll do, she said, and pulled out the plug and the battery in two smooth motions, thoroughly nuking the virtual machine she'd been working inside of and erasing all the passwords and keys she might have entered. I didn't even bother to object. I wasn't even particularly offended. That'll do, huh? You just nuke any copies you have of those files, starting with the Darknet site you gave them details on, and you can forget about Ziz and Carrie Johnstone forever. I've taken the precaution of emailing myself a full set of docs, so that's that. They want to know if you want your old phone back. Huh? They burgled some Egyptian girl's house after grabbing your old handset's location from the carrier's network. Jesus, did they hurt anyone? They didn't mention, so I'm assuming no. They're capable of some subtlety. Sounds like it bought you some time in any event. You want it back? They've probably filled it with every bug and Trojan known to the human race, of course. Forget it, I said. Smart guy, she said. Yeah, well, thanks, I guess. I felt like something simultaneously monumental and boring had just happened. Once again, someone else had solved my problems for me. People thought Mikey was some kind of action hero, but I was just a player in someone else's plot. She climbed painfully to her feet, faced me. You did pretty great, Marcus. I gave you a lot of shit, but you did great. I relied on you, and I got you into trouble. I'm glad I was able to clean up my mess. And I saved my own ass, too, I think. She wobbled a little on her legs, then put her arm out to steady herself and caught hold of my shoulder in a death grip that I barely noticed, because she was staring at me with huge, liquid brown eyes. It was one of those moments, those girl-boy moments, where there's breath passing between you, gazes locked, a kind of falling feeling from every nerve ending, inside and out. I let the moment move me and her together, and let the kiss that had been waiting inside us to come out. It went on for a long, long time, and she squeezed me like I was the only thing holding her up. We came up for breath, and she went on holding me, turning her face into my chest. I could feel the dampness from her hair, but I could also tell by the little shaking movements of her back and chest that she was crying. Hey, so was I. She snuffled up her snot and wiped her cheeks on my t-shirt and let go of me. Well, she said with a sad smile, nice to see you again, Marcus. I'll look you up the next time I'm in the neighborhood. Yeah, I said. Sounds good. The door opened downstairs and my parents' voices came up through the vents, talking about money worries and what to have for dinner. We stood, eyes locked, until they moved into the kitchen. Then we descended the stairs in silence. I opened the front door and Masha slipped out into the street, limping down Potrero Hill with her gym bag over her shoulder. I watched her until she turned onto 24th Street, but she never looked back at me. Then I went inside and told my parents I'd lost my job. Ange could tell something was up from the minute I called her. I could hear it in her voice.
and she met me at a burrito joint around the corner from Noisebridge, coming straight to the table and sitting down opposite me without a hug or a kiss or any of the other normal pleasantries. "I saw Masha," I said, "and she spoke to Johnstone's people, and they say it's over." "Over," she said flatly. "As in, we don't have anything to do with them, they don't have anything to do with us. Over." "Oh," she said. She bit her lip, the way she did when she was thinking hard. "Over. You believe her?" "Yeah," I said, "I do." "Oh." I thought about this next part 1,000 times, rehearsed every way it could go, hated all of them, decided I needed to do it anyway. "Ange," I said. She started crying before I said anything else, so I guess my voice must have conveyed some secret message to her in the cipher known only to our bodies and subconscious minds. "What comes after this?" I said, trying to keep my voice even. Other people in the restaurant were staring at us, even though I'd deliberately staked out a place in the back corner. "What do you mean?" she said, taking napkins out of the dispenser on the table and wiping at her eyes. "I mean, do we just keep dating forever? Do we get married?" "You..." she blinked. "You want to get married?" "No," I said. "Do you?" "No," she said. "Ever?" "Well, I don't know. Maybe. But not to me." "I didn't say that, Marcus. Jesus, you're being such a freak. Are you breaking up with me?" I willed myself not to flinch away from her angry gaze. "I just feel like there comes a point where you have to ask yourself, is this going to go on forever or isn't it? Are we doing this for the long haul or is this just something we're doing for now?" "That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard," she said. "This isn't binary. We can be boyfriend and girlfriend without being husband and wife. We're young. What the hell is this all about?" I thought about the weird silences with Van, the kiss with Masha, the times I'd woken up next to Ange and just watched her breathe, in love with every curve and angle of her face. I thought about being a person who did things instead of someone that the world did stuff to. I thought about the system and how broken it all was. "Look, it's been intense lately. I don't know what I'm feeling anymore. I'm just not sure about anything anymore." "That's it? You're not sure? Since when was anything sure? Listen, you lunk. You say that you're not sure about anything. Are you sure that you're happier when you're with me than when I'm not there? Not all the time, but on balance, most of the time?" It was such a weird Ange way of framing the question, but I gave it thought. "Yeah," I said. "Yeah, I am sure about that. But, Ange..." She wadded up the napkin and dropped it on the table. "That's something I'm sure of, too. But you're clearly going through some crazy mental crap, and if you need to work it out, you need to work it out. Give me a call when you've sorted it out. Maybe I'll still be around." It took everything I had not to chase after her as she left the burrito place. But I stayed in my seat, facing away from the door, staring at the burrito cooling in front of me. I gave her a decent interval to get a ways down Mission Street. Then I left the place myself, leaving the food untouched. I hung around across the street from the Jonas for State Senate campaign office, wearing track pants, a hooded sweatshirt, and carrying a gym bag, figuring that what worked for Masha would probably work for me. Autumn was on us, and the sun had set early, making me just one more anonymous, slightly menacing guy with his hands in his pockets on a street in the Upper Mission. But I wasn't clutching a vial of rock. I was holding onto a USB stick. I hadn't been able to talk this over with anyone. Talking to Daryl meant talking to Van, and that meant being a theoretically single man talking to his theoretical best friend's girlfriend, who had some kind of theoretical crush on him that might or might not be theoretically mutual. Jolie was busy with Kylie because what had failed so miserably for me had worked really well for him. And of course, there was no way to talk to Ange about anything now, and maybe never again. Liam left the building. Then the speechwriter and the researchers whose names I forgot. Then some volunteers with Floor behind them. I was sure I'd seen Joe go in there, but Floor locked the door behind her, so maybe I'd missed Joe somehow. But I'd seen a few lights on inside the office as she shut the door, and so I hung tight. Joe came out 20 minutes later wearing his Joe uniform, his cardigan buttoned high against the chill night. I crossed the street and matched his stride. He looked at me, did a double take.
"Hello, Marcus,"
he said, his voice gentle and unconcerned, statesmanlike. I held out my closed fist, hand down. "Here," I said. He held his hand out, let me transfer the USB stick to him. He felt it, put it in his pocket.
"Do I want to know what this is?"
"No," I said. "But your friend in the FBI might."
"Aha," he said, and patted his pocket. "Well, I'll take that under advisement."
We walked on for a few steps.
"Is this going to get me into trouble, Marcus?"
"No," I said.
"Is it going to get you into trouble?"
"Don't know," I said. "Are you going to win the election?"
"It seems likely," he said. "That vote machine idea of yours, whoa. Though nothing's certain in politics."
"I know," I said. "I'm a member of the network. I recruited 16 people for my contact list. Maybe I'll get a pizza and beer party invite." He stifled a small, sad laugh.
"You're always welcome to pizza on me, Marcus."
"Well, that's good," I said. "Keep them honest, okay?"
"I'll certainly try."
"And keep yourself honest."
"Yes. That much you can be sure of," he said.
I walked away. As I walked into the night, back toward home, I felt a huge weight lift from my shoulders. It's funny because I assumed that after I started the chain of events that would lead to Carrie Johnstone's docs ending up in an FBI agent's possession, I would be clobbered by worry. Would Carrie Johnstone come back for me? Would Ziz come after me? They'd have no reason to assume I turned over the docs to the FBI, but no reason not to, either. Hell, maybe the FBI wouldn't do anything. What had Joe said? Even the most foolish, vicious Phoebe at HQ in D.C. has some self-respect and doesn't want to be used as a game token by scheming politicians who are hoping to score points with the electorate during the midterms. Maybe they'd just drop it in a shredder. But somehow, that little voice I knew to be my own, the little voice that told me all the time about the ways I'd screwed up, the way I'd let other people do the driving, the way I let life push me around, that little voice shut up the instant I did something. And not just something. The exact thing I knew to be right. Because if the system was broken, if Carrie Johnstone wasn't ever going to pay consequences for her actions, it wasn't because the system failed to get her. It was because people like me chose not to act when we could. The system was people, and I was part of it, part of its problems. And I was going to be part of the solution from now on.
Epilogue.
I'd had 8 months to debug Secret Project X1. I even made a special midsummer trip to the Mojave, where the gypsum dust was nearly identical to the stuff you got out on the playa. I'd watched with glee and pride as X1 sucked up the sun's rays, turned them into a laser beam, and used that to sinter fine white powder into 3D shapes. First, a little skull ring. Then, a toy car. Then, some chain mail, the links already formed and joined, one of the coolest tricks 3D printing had to offer. I gave a presentation on my progress one night at Noise Bridge, and the resulting praise had given me a glow you could have seen with a spy drone. But now, here, on the actual playa, the goddamned machine wouldn't work. Lemmy sat in his lounger nearby, sipping electrolyte drink from a camelback, and making helpful suggestions, as well as several unhelpful ones. Burners passing by stopped and asked what I was doing, and I let Lemmy explain it to them so that I could concentrate on the infernal and stubborn machine. I only stopped when I found that even the light from my headlamp wasn't sufficient for seeing what I was doing, and then I stretched all the aches and pains out of my body, swilled a pint of cold brew, and proceeded to dance my skinny ass off for 45 minutes straight, chasing after a giant art car, blasting ferocious dubstep as it crawled across the open playa. I stopped as a thunderstrike of inspiration struck me. I ran straight back to camp, unlocked Lemmy's car, and used its dome light to confirm that, yes, I had in fact inserted a critical part of the power assembly backwards. I turned it around, slotted it in, and heard the familiar boot sequence kick in as the stored power from the solar panels kicked the 3D printer to life. I wasn't a total moron after all. It didn't matter how much dancing I'd done the night before. I was for goddamned sure getting up at first light to crank up X1. I had a lot of printing to do. I puttered around it as the blue arc of laser light shone out of its guts, making it glow like a lantern in the pink dawn. People stopped and asked me what I was doing. I gave them trinkets, bone-white skull rings, renderings of perfect knots and other mathematical solids, strange, ghostly figurines. I had a whole library of 3D shapes I'd plundered from Thingiverse when I realized that I was going to have a real functional 3D printer on the playa this year. Word got around, and by the time Lemmy got out of bed, a huge crowd had gathered around our camp. Dancers who'd been up all night, their pupils the size of saucers, early risers with yoga mats, college kids who'd somehow found themselves at the burn, and a familiar Jawa with crossed bandoliers over her chest, emphasizing her breasts. "Hi, Ange," I said, leaving Lemmy to run the machine while I grabbed us a jar of cold brew and walked off a ways with her. She pulled down her mask. The sun had toasted a smattering of freckles around her nose and cheeks. I gave her first slurp at the coffee, then I had one. Then we hugged. It was awkward. It was wonderful. "Hey, Marcus. Congratulations on getting it working." "Yeah," I said. All I wanted to do was hug her again. "So," I said. "So," she said. "I'm an idiot," I said. "Yeah," she said. "I've missed you." "Yeah," she said again. "I missed you too." Like fire. Like part of me had been cut away. I dropped my voice. "I gave Johnstone's docs to the FBI. She blinked twice. "When?" "Back in October." "And you're still here, huh?" "Yeah," I said. "I guess that means they didn't do anything with it." "Or maybe it means they did do something with it." I found my mouth was hanging open. "You know," I said, "that possibility never occurred to me." "Yeah," she said. "You have a tendency to see the bad side of things." "I guess I do." We didn't say anything for a while. Just drank our coffee. "Have you seen anything great yet?" "No," I said. "I've been working on that goddamned machine since the moment we arrived." "I haven't been to the temple yet," she said. I took the hint. "I bet Lemmy will be okay with the printer for a while. You think?" "Yeah, let's go." "You spending much time at the protests?" she said. "Every day," I said. "Trying to figure out how to do more with the kind of technology we built at Noisebridge to help make them harder to bust up. Better anti-kettling stuff, herf shielding, effective treatments for gas poisoning, and those dazzler lasers and sound cannons they're using now. Been arrested a few times, but I keep going back." "I think that's great," she said. "Seriously great. I'm proud of you." "Thank you," I said. "That means a lot." It really did. I didn't hold her hand, but oh, how I wanted to. "What about you?" "College," she said. "College, college, college. Doing a double course load to get out as fast as I can. My student debt, God, it's like the national debt of some drowning island nation." "There's still time to drop out," I said. "Yeah, yeah, we can't all be professional revolutionaries." "Not if you're drowning in student debt," is what I didn't say. Because I didn't want to fight with Ange. More than anything, I didn't want to fight with Ange. The temple came into sight. It was even more amazing than last year's. And it was surrounded by art bikes and milling crowds of people dropping off their memorials, or reading them, or making them. By the same unspoken agreement, we walked to them in silence. By some unspoken agreement, we took each other's hands. When we sat down in the central atrium, and the first deep Om moved through us, tears began to flow. Ange was crying, and so was I. Our fingers were interlocked, and squeezed so hard that my knuckles creaked. But the sound kept coming, and with it, a kind of peace. Peace wasn't something I'd had much of in the last year, and I barely recognized it. And then I sank into it. My eyes closed. I sensed someone settle to the floor next to me. I opened my eyes. I knew before they opened who it would be. Masha's hair was pink again, and she looked better than she had the last time I'd seen her. But she also looked older. There were deep worry lines around her mouth and eyes. They looked good on her somehow. Her eyes were the same, and just as I'd remembered them. She and I looked into each other's eyes for a long time. I squeezed Ange's fingers and sensed her looking at Masha, too. The three of us stared at one another. Three pairs of eyes, three brains, three sets of hands. Three people inside the crowd, inside the temple, inside Black Rock City, on the skin of the planet. Then Masha stood up, blew us both a kiss, and smiled in a way that made her look 10 years old and made me feel like I'd been blessed by a holy woman. I gathered Ange into a hug that started off stiff and awkward, and then turned into the most familiar feeling in the world.
Bibliography. When I was a kid, facts were hard to come by. If you wanted to know how to hack a payphone, you'd have to find someone else who knew how to do it and get them to teach you. Or you'd have to find operating manuals for payphones and pore over them until you came up with your own method. There's nothing wrong with either of these solutions, except that they're slow and can be tedious. Today, facts are cheap. As I typed this in early 2012, a Google search for how to hack a payphone gives back a full screen of detailed YouTube videos full of fascinating and often practical advice on getting payphones to dance to your will. So, if you know or suspect that a thing is possible, it's easy to discover whether someone has managed it and how they did it. Just bear in mind Arthur C. Clarke's first law. When a distinguished but elderly scientist says that something is possible, he's almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he is very probably wrong. If you're trying to do something that everyone else on the net swears is impossible, it still might be worth a go on your own in case you think of something they've never imagined. With Homeland and in Little Brother, I've tried to give you some scenarios and keywords that might expand your impression of what is and isn't possible. To give you the search terms, you'll need to educate yourself and get yourself doing cool stuff. For example, if you Google hackerspaces, you'll find that places like Noisebridge are very real and have spread all over the world. Noisebridge is also real. You can join your local hackerspace. If it doesn't exist, you can start it. Just Google, how do I start a hackerspace? And while you're searching, try drone and Tor project and lawful intercept. You'll be amazed, scared, energized, and empowered by what you find there. Wikipedia is an amazing place to do research, but you have to know how to use it. Your teachers probably told you that Wikipedia has no place in your education, and I'm sorry to say that I think that this is a lazy and dumb approach. There are two secrets to doing amazing research on Wikipedia. One, check the sources, not the article. In an ideal world, all the factual assertions in a Wikipedia article will have a citation to a source at the bottom of the article. Wikipedia has not achieved this ideal state, yet that's what all those citation needed marks in the articles are about. But a surprising number of the facts in a Wikipedia article will have a corresponding source at the bottom. That's where your research should take you when you're reading an article. Wikipedia is where your research should start, not where it should end. 2. Check the talk link. Every Wikipedia article has a talk link that goes to a page where everyone who cares about the article discusses its state. If someone has a weird idea about a subject and finds a source somewhere on the net to support it, they might just stick it into the Wikipedia article, but chances are this will spark a heated debate on the talk page about whether the source is reputable and whether its facts belong in an encyclopedia. Armed with the original sources and the informed discussion about whether those sources are good ones, you can use Wikipedia to get yourself an amazing education. Beyond Wikipedia, there are some other sites that you should really have a look at if you want to learn more about the material in this book. First, Code Academy. www.codecademy.com, that's CodeCademy.com, which contains step-by-step lessons to learn how to program, starting from no knowledge. You can even get them by email, one page at a time. While you're chewing on that, check out the Tor Project, www.torproject.com, that's T-O-R, and find out how to run your own darknet projects. If you're looking to use an operating system that lets you control your whole computer down to the bare metal, then you want GNU/Linux. I like the Ubuntu flavor best, that's www.ubuntu.com. It runs on any and every computer and is really easy to get started with. And if you have an Android phone, get jailbreaking. The CyanogenMod project, www.cyanogenmod.com, CyanogenMod.com, is a free stroke open version of the Android operating system with all kinds of excellent features, including several that will help you protect your privacy. Now, all this stuff is well and good, but only if the internet stays free and open. If your country acquires the same awful censorship and surveillance used in China and Middle Eastern dictatorships, you won't be able to get at this stuff and learn how to use it. There are lots of threats to this freedom, and every country has groups devoted to stopping them. In the United States and Canada, and worldwide, there's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, www.eff.org, where I used to work. In the UK, there's the Open Rights Group, www.openrightsgroup.org, which I helped to found. In Australia, there's Electronic Frontiers Australia, www.efa.org.au. In New Zealand, there's Creative Freedom, creativefreedom.org.nz. There are global groups like Creative Commons, www.creativecommons.org, and groups with lots of local affiliates like the Pirate Party, www.pp-international.net. There are lots of thinkers on this stuff whom I have a lot of respect for. If you want to know more about teens, privacy, and network communications, read Dana Boyd's blog at zephoria.org/thoughts. For more on Anonymous, 4chan, and B, read Gabriella Coleman's blog and papers at www.gabriellacoleman.org/blog. For the future of news and newspapers, read Dan Gilmore, www.dangilmore.com, that's D-A-N-G-I-L-L-M-O-R, and especially his excellent book Media Active, www.mediaactive.com, that's M-E-D-I-A-C-T-I-V-E. For the changing relationship of links to the news, follow Heather Brook, www.heatherbrook.org, and read her History of WikiLeaks, The Revolution Will Be Digitized. To understand how the net is changing the world, read Clay Shirky, www.shirky.com, and his latest book, The Kick-Ass Here Comes Everybody. If you want to fight for free and fair elections in America without undue influence from power and money, read Lawrence Lessig, twitter.com/Lessig, and join Root Strikers, www.rootstrikers.org, where activists are making it happen. Finally, if you want to understand randomness, information theory, and the strange world at the center of mathematics, run, don't walk, and get a copy of James Gleick's 2011 book, The Information. It's where I got all that good stuff about Gödel and Chaitin from. There's plenty more than would ever fit between the covers of a book, so much more that you need a whole net for it. I write on a daily website called Boing Boing, www.boingboing.net, where I keep up to date on the latest stuff. I hope to see you there.
Afterword by Aaron Swartz, read by Noah Swartz.
Hi there. I'm Noah, Aaron's brother. I've been given a little space at the end of this book because I'm a flesh-and-blood human, and as such, I can tell you some things you wouldn't believe if it came out of the mouth of any of these fictional characters. This stuff is real. Sure, there isn't actually anyone named Marcus or Angie, at least not that I know. But I do know real people just like them. If you want, you can go to San Francisco and meet them. And while you're there, you can play D&D with John Gilmore, or build a rocket ship in Noisebridge, or work with some hippies on an art project for Burning Man. And if some of the more conspiracy-minded stuff in the book seems too wild to be true, well, just Google Blackwater, XE, or Bluecoat. I myself have a FOIA request in to learn more about persona management software, but the feds say it'll take more than 3 years to redact all the relevant documents. Now, I hope you had fun staying up all night reading about these things. But the next part is important, so pay attention. What's going on now isn't some reality TV show you can just sit at home and watch. This is your life. This is your country. And if you want to keep it safe, you need to get involved. I know it's easy to feel like you're powerless. Like there's nothing you can do to slow down or stop the system. Like all the calls are made by shadowy and powerful forces far outside your control. I feel that way too sometimes, but it just isn't true. A little over a year ago, a friend called to tell me about an obscure bill he'd heard of called Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeiting Act, or COICA. As I read the bill, I started to get more and more worried. Under its provisions, the government would be allowed to censor websites it didn't like, without so much as a trial. It would be the first time the U.S. government was given the power to censor its citizens' access to the net. The bill had just been introduced a day or two ago, but it already had a couple dozen senators co-sponsoring it. And, despite there never being any debate, it was already scheduled for a vote in just a couple days. Nobody had ever reported on it, and that was just the point. They wanted to rush this thing through before anyone noticed. Luckily, my friend noticed. We stayed up all weekend and launched a website explaining what the bill did, with a petition you could sign opposing it that would look up the phone number of your representatives. We told a few friends about it, and they told a few friends. And within a couple of days, we had over 200,000 people on our petition. It was incredible. Well, the people pushing this bill didn't stop. They spent literally tens of millions of dollars lobbying for it. The head of every major media company flew out to Washington, D.C. and met with the president's chief of staff to politely remind him of the millions of dollars they donated to the presidential campaign and explain how what they wanted, the only thing they wanted, was for this bill to pass. But the public pressures kept building. To try and throw people off the trail, they kept changing the name of the bill, calling it PIPA or SOPA, and even the E-Parasites Act. But no matter what they called it, more and more people kept telling their friends about it and getting more and more people opposed. Soon, the signers on our petition stretched into the millions. We managed to stall them for over a year through various tactics, but they realized if they waited much longer, they might never get their chance to pass the bill. So they scheduled it for a vote first thing after they got back from winter break. But while members of Congress were off on winter break, holding town halls and public meetings back home, people started visiting them. Across the country, members started getting asked by their constituents why they were supporting this nasty internet censorship bill. And members started getting scared, some going so far as to respond by attacking me. But it wasn't about me anymore. It was never about me. From the beginning, it was about citizens taking things into their own hands, making YouTube videos and writing songs opposing the bill, making graphs showing how much money the bill's co-sponsors had received from the industries pushing it, and organizing boycotts putting pressure on the companies who'd endorsed the bill. And it worked. It took the bill from a political non-issue that was poised to pass unanimously to a toxic football no one wanted to touch. Even the bill's co-sponsors started rushing to issue statements opposing it. Boy, were those media moguls pissed. This is not how the system is supposed to work. A ragtag bunch of kids doesn't stop one of the most powerful forces in Washington just by typing on their laptops. But it did happen, and you can make it happen again. The system is changing. Thanks to the internet, everyday people can learn about and organize around an issue, even if the system is determined to ignore it. Now, maybe we won't win every time. This is real life, after all. But we finally have a chance. But it only works if you take part. Now that you've read the book and learned how to do it, you're perfectly suited to make it happen again. That's right. Now it's up to you to change the system.
Afterword by Jacob Applebaum.
Utopia is impossible. Everyone who isn't a utopian is a schmuck. Corey asked someone to write to the children of the newest generation and to say something to inspire them, to write something that would encourage them to take up the cause of bettering the world. That's you or someone you love. When you're finished, please pass this book on to the person who needs it most. Everything good in the world comes from the efforts of people who came before us. Every minute that we are able to enjoy in a society that is not ruled by senseless violence is a minute given to us by the hard work of people who dedicated their lives for something better. Every person we meet is carrying his own burdens. Each person is the center of her own universe. There is so much left to be done, so many injustices to right, so much suffering to relieve, so many beautiful moments to be lived, an endless amount of knowledge to uncover. Many secrets of the universe wait to be uncovered. The deck from which our hands are dealt need not be stacked against us. It is possible to create societal structures that are just and capable of reasoned compassion for everyone. It is possible to change the very nature of our lives. It's possible to redesign the entire deck, to change the very face and the count of the cards, to rewrite the rules and to create different outcomes. We live in the golden era of surveillance. Every phone is designed to be tapped. The internet passes through snooping equipment of agencies that are so vast and unaccountable that we hardly know their bounds. Corporations are forced, though some are willing enough, to hand over our data and data of those whom we love. Our lives are ruled by networks, and yet those networks are not ruled by our consent. These networks keep us hooked up, but it is not without cost that they keep us hooked together. The businesses, the governments, and the individuals that power those networks are incentivized to spy, to betray, and to do it silently. The architecture of the very systems produces these outcomes. This is tyranny. The architecture of our systems and of our networks is not the product of nature, but rather the product of imperfect humans, some with the best of intentions. There is no one naturally fit to survive in these unnatural systems. There are some who are lucky, others who have adapted. This letter to you, from your perhaps recent past, was written with free software, written as a labor of love by someone who wished to help the children of Uganda, while flying over an expansive ocean at difficult-to-understand heights. It was composed while running under a kernel written by scores of people across every national line, across every racial, sexual, and gender line, by a socially and politically agnostic engineer. It was sent through multiple anonymity networks, built by countless volunteers acting in solidarity through mutual aid, and it was received by an author who published it for a purpose. What is the common purpose of all these people? It is for the whole of our efforts to be more than the sum of our parts. This creates a surplus for you, to give breathing room to others, so that they may take the torch of knowledge, of reason, of justice, of truth-telling, of sunlight, to the next step, wherever it may lead us. There was a time when there were no drone killings. Societies have existed without armed policemen, where peace is not only possible but actually a steady state, where mass surveillance was technically and socially infeasible, where fair and even-handed trials by impartial juries were available for everyone, where fear of identification and arrest was not the norm but the exception. That time was less than a generation ago, and much more has been lost in the transition from one generation to the next. It's up to you to bring those things back to our planet. You can do this with little more than cooperation, the internet, cryptography, and willingness. You might do this alone, or you might do it in a group. You might contribute as a solitary person or as one of many. Writing free software empowers every person, without exception, to control the machines that fill our lives. Building free and open hardware empowers every person, without exception, to construct new machines to free us from being slaves to machines that control us. Using free and open systems allows us to construct a new basis by which we may once again understand as a whole the systems by which we govern ourselves. We are on the edge of regaining our autonomy, of ending total state surveillance, of uncovering and holding accountable those who commit crimes in our names without our informed consent, of resuming free travel without arbitrary or unfair restriction. We're on the verge of ensuring that every person, not one human excluded, has the right to read and the right to speak, without exception. It's easy to feel hopeless in the face of the difficult issues that we face every day. How might one person effectively resist anything so much larger than herself? Once we stop acting alone, we have a chance for positive change. To protest is to stop and say that you object. To resist is to stop others from going along without thinking. And to build alternatives is to give everyone new choices. Omission and commission are the yin and yang of personal agency. What if you could travel back through time and help Daniel Ellsberg leak the Pentagon Papers? Would you take the actions required? Would you risk your life to end the war? For many, it is easy to answer positively and then think nothing of the actual struggles, the real risk, or the uncertainty provided without historical hindsight. For others, it's easy to say no and to think of nothing beyond oneself. But what if you didn't need to travel back through time? There are new Pentagon Papers just waiting to be leaked. There are new wars to end, new injustices to make right, fresh uncertainty that seems daunting, where success seems impossible. New alternatives need to be constructed. Old values and concepts of justice need to be preserved in the face of powerful people who pervert the rule of law for their own benefit. Be the trouble you want to see in the world, above nationalism, above so-called patriotism, above and beyond fear, and make it count for the betterment of the planet. Legal and illegal are not the same as right and wrong. Do what is right and never give up the fight. This is one idea out of many that can help you and your friends free our planet from the tyranny that surrounds us all. It's up to you now. Go create something beautiful and help others to do the same. Happy hacking. Anonymous.
Acknowledgements. Many thanks to the people who helped with suggestions and technical details to make this book work. Jacob Applebaum, Aaron Swartz, Quinn Norton, Tiffany Cheng, Nicholas Reveal, Holmes Wilson, Joe Trippi, Danny O'Brien, Tim Hardy, Nat Torkington, Thomas Gideon, Roger Dingledon, Barry Warsaw, Gord Doctorow, Roz Doctorow, James Glick, and Lee McGuire. Thanks to my campmates at Liminal Labs for introducing me to Burning Man and making me so welcome there. Thanks to John Perry Barlow, John Gilmore, Mitch Kapoor, and Will Wheaton for letting me give them a cameo, and thanks again to Gilmore for his plotting suggestions. Thanks to my agents Rust Galen, Danny Baror, Heather Baror, and Justin Manisk for their awesome work in bringing Little Brother and Homeland to the world. Thanks to all the fans and readers, the librarians and teachers, and hackers and remixers, and especially the booksellers who put my books into people's hands. Thanks to my editors, especially Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who has always improved my books. Thank you to Will Wheaton for reading this audiobook. Thank you to Gabrielle DeQueer for her work in producing it. Thank you to Stephen Rudinicki and the people at Skyboat Media for their studio. And thank you to Noah Swartz for his reading as well. Thank you especially to John Taylor Williams for mastering and editing this audiobook and for composing the bed music that you've been enjoying. Biography. Cory Doctorow, craphound.com, is a science fiction author, activist, journalist, and blogger, the co-editor of Boing Boing, and the author of young adult novels like Pirate Cinema and Little Brother, and novels for adults like Rapture of the Nerds and Makers. He is the former European director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and co-founded the UK Open Rights Group. Born in Toronto, Canada, he now lives in London.